you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
This is The Thing About Cars, a podcast for car enthusiasts and the people who love them.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Thing About Cars. I'm Mickey Desai. Around the table, we've got Dave. How are you, Dave?
Apparently, I'm an old obscenity.
And Misty, all the way from the Netherlands, as usual. How are you, Misty?
Moist. It's been raining.
Okay. I'm sure the plant in the background really appreciates that.
But, Ben Bell's happy.
Right. And Ben, how's it going, Ben?
It's going pretty well. How about you?
It's going okay. It's good. You know, I made the mistake yesterday of cracking the windows and cracking the sunroof on my car to let some of the heat out before Jen and I went for a drive in the evening. And then it rained and I completely forgot that all of it was open.
Uh-oh.
So the car got a little damp and fortunately, moist. Yeah, moist. and fortunately not too soaked, but today I'll be out there watching the weather and seeing if I can leave the windows open and let it all dry out. But so did you guys see this thing? I don't know if you've seen this thing. There's a couple news things I want to discuss before we get to Dave's cultural collision. And before we get to Grand Trivia Auto, this chart I posted that said the frequency of car colors in America, I don't know their data source, but I think it seems plausible that the most popular color, can you guys guess the most popular car color? Did you see the chart?
Saw the chart, but it was only like this big on,
Yeah, you need to like swipe or something. I don't know. I blew it up on my screen here.
Oh, and you sent it during happy hour. So
I don't know what that here was.
Popular car color, the most frequent car color in America, without any data regarding the year the car was made or bought or whatever, appears to be white. White accounts for 23.9% of the cars represented in this chart. And white and then black is the second most popular one. The least most frequently found color on a car. Anybody want to wager a guess here?
Yellow?
Oh, I'm looking at the chart. So
it's purple.
Yeah. Purple.
Purple. Yellow's the second least popular.
One of my best friends years ago, bought a brand new purple Ford Escort.
Ah, yeah.
And it was bright, bright, bright purple. And at one point he was out in the driveway putting a rainbow sticker on the back bumper, and all the rest of us like, don't you think that's a bit redundant?
Yeah. Right?
Do you think anyone thinks that you're like a straight teamster driving a purple Escort?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I would not judge. Anything's possible. Maybe he got a good steal on it or something. But
I'm kind of sad that there's no pink on here because Friday morning? Yeah, Friday morning. Being the amazing mom that I am, I'm kicking my son out of bed at like 7:15 going, we're going to the gym at 7:30. And he's like, really, mom? So I'm like, okay, fine. We'll kind of counter that and run to McDonald's because we finally have bacon, egg, and cheese McMuffins here. I'm like driving across town. I see this pink Fiat 500 with eyelashes.
And nothing good is going to come of this.
No, I had to admit, I had a moment. I was like, oh. And my son goes, no, that should be just nuked from orbit. And I went, whatever. No imagination. It was
you know
so
what?
Cute.
At some point, car and drag, at some point your kid's going to hit on a drag queen. He'll learn the same as everybody else.
Been there.
He's having a bit of a crisis right now. Apparently his friend group is filled with ginger lesbians.
Huh. And this is a problem. Why?
I don't know. I don't see it as a problem. He's just kind of like, I don't know why this is happening to me. I don't either, dude. Just roll with it.
Ginger and lesbians.
On the bright side, he will never be without somebody to fix an outboard motor for him.
That's what I'm thinking. That's exactly what
now,
I'm thinking.
Now, by ginger, you mean redhead, right?
Yeah.
Because there's such a small percentage of the population that how many are in the group?
paint.
How many ginger lesbians are we talking about, Misty?
Let's see. Well,
how many ginger lesbians does it take to fix an upward motor?
Let's see. Well, we're talking about two.
Yes.
So, so that's two. Yeah. But then there's, this one.
All right. So while Misty's counting up the lesbians, we're going to do our grand trivia auto question. and then we've got this one news item I want to touch on real quick. From our trivia czar, Tim, we have, he says, your automotive trivia du jour. And he's actually seen this feature in use in this fashion. He says, what would you monitor? What would you monitor with a water pressure gauge / warning light installed in a dashboard? And I'm assuming this is an alternative use. Maybe, maybe not. So what would you monitor with a water pressure gauge or warning light installed in a dashboard? A, you can monitor turbocharger or supercharger boost in pounds per square inch, ensuring the turbo slash supercharger is operating and not exceeding a set pressure limit. B, you could actually measure amniotic fluid pressure, being aware of water breaking that could indicate there will soon be another passenger in the vehicle. Answer C, you can measure the pressure of the coolant in the cooling system. Be aware of the change in the pressure due to a broken fan belt, like an inoperative water pump or a burst radiator hose before the engine has time to overheat. Or D, all of the above.
This shows off to a weird start.
Yes, shows off to a weird start. Do you need me to read those again?
Oh, please.
Okay, so D, obviously, the answer D is all of the above. C is measuring the pressure of the coolant in the coolant system. B is the pressure of the amniotic fluid pressure. And answer A is measuring the turbocharger or supercharger boost in pounds per square inch. Those are our choices. So ponder that for a moment. We're going to go to this one news item. And it's this came as something of a shock to me. Ben, you want to take this one?
Yeah. Well, basically, it's Toyota up to some interesting shenanigans.
Yeah, and I didn't expect that Toyota would play dirty pool like this. But sorry, Ben, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, basically, everybody knows Toyota as the maker of the Prius and things like that, or Prius, as they say in Britain, apparently. And we won't even get into the question of the plural of Prius. What's been going on, according to some people in the know in Washington, is that Toyota have been doing some legislative maneuvers trying to basically work against electric vehicles, which seems contradictory since they're making the Prius. But remember, the Prius is a hybrid. It's still derives, you know, most of its power, well, in the case of, unless you got the plug-in one, ultimately all its power comes from gasoline. It still has a regular engine, still has to fill up at the pump. And they've been trying to do, apparently what they sort of bet against electric vehicles a while back, and they're trying to save themselves from it by doubling down against them by trying to get legislation passed that will, you know, favor things like hybrids and hydrogen fuel cells over electrics.
Right. They want to essentially thwart the production of electric vehicles, right?
Or at least slow the rollout of them.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it smacks of being too closely tied in with the petroleum industry, because like I just said, the hybrid still requires gasoline more than anything else. And there's some argument in, you know, hydrogen conversations about where the hydrogen is going to come from. A lot of people say, oh, well, you just bust it out of water through electrolysis, except that the energy input in most cases is greater than the energy that'll be yielded. And that energy still has to come from somewhere, you know, possibly a fossil fuel power plant. And one of the easiest substances to break hydrogen out of is not water, but petroleum, which is probably why some past, you know, political administrations were all hot about hydrogen. So, interesting things. Probably also causing a certain amount of hand-wringing among, you know, certain communities, at least here in the United States. I can think of one particular religious denomination that's known for being very, very liberal, where, you know, their parking lots on Sunday morning look like a Prius rally. So, yeah.
A Prius rally. That is funny and mind-boggling all at the same time.
Yeah, so I'm wondering how many of them are taking this news, those who've read it.
Well, I mean, who celebrates this development, right? Besides Toyota stock owners, and Toyota employees, who celebrates the notion that Toyota is wanting to push actual legislation that that favors the non-development of the electronic vehicle.
Well, anybody who makes money on petroleum, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what then do the rest of us do?
Oh, the rest of us are just pawns in the marketing game.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I mean, first of all, let's, you know, I don't forgive me for not mincing words because I'm usually so delicate and circumspect, but Toyota's late to the game.
Yeah.
They're late to the game in terms of engineering innovation, even by Japanese standards. I think one of the things that, from what I've read, really caught Toyota off, you know, not off guard, was the popularity of the Nissan Leaf and how that car, you know, largely knocked the Prius out of the tree hugger, you know, most favorite market space. Full disclosure, total tree hugger here.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. And it's they were late to the game. They, you know, they made token investments, but they didn't make anything really. And to Ben's point, picking hydrogen cells is a little bit like picking, you know, does it sound like a good idea? Sure. Cars that run on water also sound like a good idea. The engineering is not practical.
Yeah. Hydrogen has so many impractical points. It's, you know, it makes you wonder.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really used for rockets and for blowing crap up.
Yeah.
Right. The Hindenburg, for instance.
It's difficult to store, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, this is just more motivation to really fight to get lobbyists off the planet.
There you go.
I'm not even, you know, I'm not even playing.
Speaking of not mincing words, yes.
First colonists being sent to Mars, all of the lobbyists.
Yes. Y'all have fun with that, considering I highly doubt any of you are, you know, hunters, gatherers, crafters, you know. Well,
you guys have all read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, yes?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Many times.
So that one episode or that one chapter where that one planet put all the people on the spaceship and just shot them out to nowhere, that included... What was it? Politicians, people who cleaned the phones.
Yeah. Politicians, phone sanitizers, phone technicians.
And like marketers, I think.
Something like that.
Yeah, advertising and marketing specialists.
Right. And you know, Arthur Dent has this realization that, that's who's on this thing.
Yeah, but the sad thing was the other colony with all the useful people was wiped out by a
phone disease.
Yeah, a telephone-borne virus.
So I mean, Toyota's playing dirty pool, and I guess Ben's right. I guess there's nothing else to do except to watch and see what unfolds, except maybe call your legislator and tell the legislator to get Toyota's head out of their butts, right?
And vote with your dollars.
Right.
Yeah. Agreed. And it's probably also not a good idea to say to your legislator, congressperson,
yes,
I'm trying really hard to see things from your point of view. Unfortunately, I've come to the conclusion that I'm not flexible enough to get my head that far up my ass.
There is a more delicate way to describe that, Misty. And my previous part of my career, we used to give certain clients and managers in my company what was known as the Plexiglass Naval Award. That was so you could see where you're going with your head so far up your ass.
I like that. But on the other hand, it's also apparent that you've never lived in the 9th District in Georgia.
Oh, God. Let's not even talk about that.
I think the medical term is cranial rectal inversion, right?
Right.
That's it. That's
as long
it.
As that's not the title of this episode, that's right. Good. Right.
So I guess I'm out of doing the show notes.
No, if you do the show notes, it has to be called Ginger Lesbians, something like that.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of, I finished my calculations, and Ginger Lesbians make up about 1/4 to 1/3 of the group.
Your son has got his priorities in the wrong place, Misty.
I don't know. They're a great group of kids. Yeah, they're in their 20s, but they're a great group of kids. And
once again, the show evolves into a random story problem.
Well, you know, I thought maybe we should open with the picture you posted, Dave, of the butter melting in the pan. And I was going to make a comment to the effect of that that watching butter melt in a pan is just kind of pleasant, right? It's sort of
it's mesmerizing
and sexy all at the same time. Yeah.
So if a Prius carrying four ginger lesbians departs at 5:30 and goes 50 miles an hour.
Departs Amsterdam at 7:15 AM.
Right.
You know, how many cups of coffee have they consumed by the time they hit Eindhoven? That's it.
Dave, what's our cultural collision for today?
So actually, cultural collision is a conversation I've been wanting to have with Ben. And the subject line of this is, when does a car become a classic versus just being old? Now, the context for this, you know, I've been driving my Jeep Wrangler for, you know, since I bought it in 2008, and I loved it. And last week, my partner and I were out of town and went to go pick up the rental car, and they had a brand new Wrangler Sahara, and went and drove it, and it was wonderful. It was everything I love about my Jeep, with a couple of really nice improvements, and just enjoyed the hell out of it. And was thinking, you know, I came back and just, you know, Googled the question, first of all, you know, when is a car a classic versus a antique? And the rule of thumb, which has been set by the insurance industry, is a car is considered a classic if it's 20 years old. A car is considered an antique if it's 40 or more years old. But just the age alone couldn't be a classic designator. And I'm basing this on the first car I truly loved. In 1996, I bought a brand new Mercury Capri convertible. I alone in the world really loved this car. Everyone else, you know, thought it, you know, it was a knockoff Miata, and I fielded all kinds of unkind comments, but I adored that car, and I would probably still have it today, but it would not be considered classic. It would just be considered old. So the question I put in front of the field, mostly, you know, in front of my esteemed colleague Mr. Lauer, is what beyond that age mark, what makes a car classic versus just being old?
Snob appeal.
We're not mincing words at all this episode. This is just...
Well, yeah, I mean, think about it. Because the whole trying to parse out definitions for these reminds me of that scene toward the beginning of the Dead Poets Society where, you know, Robin Williams' character is having the boys in the class read that forward in the poetry textbook about, you know, putting poems on a scale, then having them rip the pages out. you know, to me, it's all in the eye of the beholder. Now, that said, you can take something like, say, a you know, 65 or 66 Mustang. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And you can pick one up for $15,000 to $25,000, depending on the particulars. You can take a 65 or 66 Ferrari and pick one up for about 100,000 times that. You know, it's just a kind of a matter of, it's not so much the age, it's everything else. It's all the subjective stuff.
Right. It is. I'm sorry, Misty. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it's just hitting me. I don't think it's necessarily snob appeal as much as it's romance.
Yeah. That's a kinder way to put it.
Yeah. I think there's romance, but there's also that there's the experience level. So my neighbor a couple doors down has a few Model Ts in his basement, and he takes them out and driving, you know, and everyone in the neighborhood knows when he's doing it because it sounds like he's starting up an international harvester. And coincidentally, the experience of riding in a Model T is like riding in an international harvester.
Oh, yeah. So, a little, you know, comfier, I think, but depending on the model of harvester.
That harvester might be. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the harvester, especially a newer harvester, is probably a good deal more comfortable than Model T. Yeah, so I was trying to look at it, is there an experience level? Is there something about driving beyond the snob appeal? There's something about driving Yellow Lotus or the CX-5 that Misty has that you know that extends beyond just we think this is valuable because other people have told us it's valuable.
Right.
That and there's the other side of, or maybe not the other side, but I guess the close companion of experience, which is commitment. Because when a car gets to a certain age and a certain, I don't know, rarity or whatever you want to call it, your life becomes a little more difficult. You know, maintenance requirements of really old vehicles can be really high compared to modern cars. And so the commitment of ownership to keep it operable, let alone gorgeous, you know, you run into some pretty high bars there. And whether you express that commitment through your own blood, sweat, and tears, or through having deep pockets to pay somebody else to do it, and it can be pretty deep pockets in some cases.
But yeah, again, that's a good point, because you've put more, you have more commitment to the Yellow Lotus than I've had to some human beings that I dated.
Exactly.
That's well said. That's exactly well said. But I mean, we're talking about this weird cultural phenomenon, right? It's a cultural. Oh man, what am I trying to say here? It's a cultural phenomenon that separates classic from antique, from modern versus old, right? There's no real objective measuring of these things unless you're an actuary.
It's a moving target too, because right. one of the things I looked up just before we went on here, I went on the Georgia Department of Revenue website, because as most of you, well, probably all four of us and most of our listeners probably know, you know, Georgia, like most U.S. states, has a special license plate for old cars. Georgia's is called Hobby Antique. It's not much to look at. It's just black printing on a white background, and it's got a little picture of something that kind of looks like a Model T next to the number. And the only qualification for it is that your vehicle is at least 25 years old. So here we are in 2021. That means a 1996 model year car qualifies for it. And this is a car that may well have anti-lock brakes and an OBD system. So it's no real patina thing with regards to how old cars feel.
Can you imagine seeing that antique license on like a 1998 Renault appliance?
Yeah, that'd be something. I have seen it on some 80s cars. I don't know if I've seen it on anything from the 90s yet. I think most 90s cars people don't really want to bother with. But I'll add, too, that this plate is not a very good deal. It's an extra, it's an extra $25 manufacturing fee up front. And then it's an extra $35 to renew every year. And for that, you know, you don't get any particular advantages. In fact, for the same money, you can get a personalized plate and have a lot more fun, which is what I've got on your Lotus.
It's a weird personal vanity plate of its own kind. It's like you buy it just in case there was any doubt that your car was old.
If you want to tell the world your car is old, but you're too stuffy to have fun with your plate number, then
right,
then it's for you.
Right.
I have to admit, though, you know, continuously hearing Ben's stories about your Lotus makes me very satisfied with my hobby of antique sewing machines.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I have literally hit my 1932 Pfaff with a wrench to realign her priorities.
Oh, yeah. Well, and not to get too far off here, but in my job, which is working on analytical instruments used in quality control in the plastics industry, most of the machines I work with were made, you know, in this century, or, you know, either early 2000s or up to the present, and occasionally one from the 90s maybe. But sometimes just disturbing the guts puts the fear into the machine and it straightens up. And these are digital. Yeah. These are digitally controlled, you know, very electronic machines.
Right.
But
I think you've also described Misty's approach to mothering.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
And you can get your fingers dirty with sewing machines, but you don't have to crawl completely under them and have fluids dump on you when you loosen things. And
let me send you the schematic for threading my serger, my four thread double needle serger. You literally need like a PhD in electronic engineering for that.
Jen's got one, and and I looked at that thing like it was some sort of arcane implement that I just didn't want to have any knowledge of. It was just
probably more complex than a manual transmission, which really isn't very complicated.
Right.
Yeah. No, and I think that's a good point, because when you look at the complexity of it, again, I will tell you that I am not sanguine about tools. I do not get sentimental to tools, because if something new comes out that lets me do something better, faster, easier, I will replace the old tool with the new tool. Yet, conversely, like Misty, I have my grandmother's 1932 Singer sewing machine.
Wow.
That my father taught me how to sew nice. Boat canvases and tent canvases on.
Cool.
And this thing, honest to God, could take a missile hit. You know, yeah. If somebody, you know, blows up Virginia Highlands, that sewing machine is going to brush it off and you know, keep on going.
Right. Well, I've got two. I've got the 1930s Bath, which is a hand crank, and then I've got a 1950 Singer Treadle, which was, I think, 306K, which was the first semi-industrial treadle sewing machine that also does zigzag and reverse.
Yeah, but how fast does it go from 0 to 60?
It depends on how fast I move my feet. There are times I've kind of had to go, whoa, we need to slow down here.
To go back to Dave's original question, I think we should pose it to our audience as well when this episode publishes, which is, what is it that separates classic from simply old? Something I think Ben just said, are any of the cars from the 90s ever going to be regarded as classic? Because that's when we started to see, you know, just sort of the template creation of cars and the degradation of style, I think.
Yeah, that was the one thing that the 90s is, you know, known for in the automotive world is what's known as being the jelly bean era of automotive design. Mm-hmm. Look at a 96 Taurus and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of kind of rounded organic shapes and a lot of really kind of forgettable things. But right. there were a few little notables in there, even among pretty inexpensive vehicles. For instance, I think there were a couple of Chryslers that on one particular trim level had little hot pink trim accents. You know, a trend that was entirely forgettable the following year. But if any of those survive a few more years, somebody's going to show up at, say, a Radwood event with one of them.
Yeah.
And it'll ultimately become a little collectible. A lot of collectability is based on things that were thrown away when they were new because they were not immediately appreciated.
True.
And of course, in some higher end cars, you have some notable things in the 90s. There's a certain little market segment there, a certain, you know, bracket of years in which front engine Porsches took on the 928 style pop-up headlights. They're regarded as pretty ugly during the day, but I think they're gaining a little collectability right now.
Yeah.
You know, little small things like that.
So let's do ask our audience that, their opinions. What is it that separates classic from simply old? So our grand trivia auto question, before we wrap up this episode, we should probably answer that from Trivia Czar Tim. He sends this question. He says, what could you monitor with a water pressure gauge / warning light installed in your dashboard? Could you measure the amniotic fluid pressure to be aware of water breaking that can indicate there will soon be another passenger in the vehicle? Could you measure the pressure of coolant in the cooling system so you could be aware of any changes in pressure due to a broken fan belt, like, you know, an inoperative water pump or a burst radiator hose before the engine has time to overheat? Or could you measure turbocharger or supercharger boost in pounds per square inch to ensure your turbo or supercharger is operating and properly and not exceeding a set pressure limit? Or could it simply be all of the above? Dave, you want to take the first guess?
Well, one of the things that strikes me as you're using the word could versus would. Could you measure amniotic pressure? Sure. Would you measure amniotic pressure? Probably not.
And does the gauge have a fine enough resolution for the difference involved?
And my experience being the brother of an OBGYN is that the noise level tells you much more about the impending third passenger than a pressure gauge is going to be. So
I can verify that from personal experience.
So I'm going to go with the cooling system.
Cooling system, the pressure in the cooling system. Misty, what do you think?
Yeah, I've been tossing it up between the cooling system and the turbo, but I think I'm going to have to go with the coolant system as well.
And Ben?
Yeah, I was thinking too that all of them could technically happen. the measuring apparatus for the one we've already discussed could be interesting, but exactly how you position the sensor and what kind you use and that sort of thing. But no, I think the cooling system is the most likely, given that Tim has, you know, seen this in use with his racing background. I think there probably is at least one race car out there that's actually got a, you know, cooling system pressure gauge. You could do it with the turbo because they're both gauges that measure pressure. They probably both read in PSI, although a lot of turbo boost gauges read in bar, particularly if they're European. But, you know, most likely someone is going to, you know, unless they just dug in a box of parts, they're going to use the one that's most appropriately designed. So in a race car, yeah, probably coolant pressure, or maybe just someone on the road who cares about too many details.
So your guess is also the pressure of the coolant in the system.
Yeah.
So you can make sure something like your belt doesn't, or your water pump hasn't seized or anything like that.
And in racing, the applications are much, much higher demand, you know, so you might want to know more things than you would in a road car.
I'm thinking also the installation is a lot less life-threatening than the amniotic.
Yeah. Well, all three of you guessed the pressure of the coolants in the coolant system. And the answer is actually amniotic fluid pressure. I'm kidding. It's not. The answer is, in fact, you all got it right. It's the pressure of the coolant in the cooling system. So you can use it for its intended purpose, basically. So there you go. That light in your dashboard tells you if it goes on to turn off the engine and pull over, or the other way around, pull over and then turn off the engine. And right. I desperately wanted this to be all of the above.
And, you know, from a racing standpoint, it could be a safety item, too, because if you blow coolant all over the track, then you've created a big hazard for all your other drivers.
Right.
Because unlike water, you know, if you've got a little bit, well, I don't know what racers use, but if it's like the road coolant that's got a little ethylene glycol in it, it can be pretty slippery.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Let's not talk about what happens if you blow amniotic fluid all over the track.
Oh, it's terrible.
Oh, my. Yeah.
Let's just say that there was concern that I would mess up my husband's 1999.
And if a baby driver. is born, you know, on the track during a race, do they come out swallowed in Nomex?
No, but you actually have to name them Carson.
Well, isn't there a penalty? You can't have like a navigator in your car or anything like that. Could the baby then qualify as the navigator of rally races or something?
In rallying, perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Baby, well, really. I think they have to be verbal. I think they have to, like, you know, actually be able to verbalize.
Thank you, Tim, for the trivia of the day. It's a good one, I think. The amniotic thing made me laugh. So that's it. That's what we've got for today. That's our Grand Trivia Auto question. I wanted to thank all of our listeners for joining us. As always, thank you for being part of our little Thing About Cars family. My friends here, do we have any other parting words before we knock off this episode?
If you enjoyed the episode, give us positive reviews online.
Oh, yeah.
If you are part of the ginger lesbian contingent of our listeners and did not appreciate this, then please take it out on All Things Considered.
That's what I'm talking about.
Right on. And in the meantime, we hope you're all staying safe and dry and off of the slick spots on the road. We will see you with another episode in about a week.
See ya.
Laters.
Listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.